At the top of our program in Michigan, more than 350 people are currently serving mandatory life sentences in prison for crimes they committed as juveniles. In 2012, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that going forward, states could no longer automatically sentence juveniles guilty of serious crimes to life without parole. They declared that cruel and unusual punishment. Now, the High Court has begun studying whether to extend the ruling retroactively to those sentenced before the ruling 3 years ago. Our next guest is a Lansing-based reporter who's been exploring the issue through the words of the convicts who have a shot at freedom. Over the course of a couple of months, Craig Mauger exchanged letters with about a dozen Michigan prisoners, some of them still relatively young, about their time behind bars and what the possibility of release means to them. I spoke with Craig Mauger yesterday and first asked him how the idea took shape.
So in 2012, the U.S. Supreme Court made a ruling in the Miller v. Alabama case that essentially said that going forward, it is not it's not right to have mandatory sentences of life with no chance of parole for people who are under 18 at the time of their crimes. So that happened in 2012. In 2013, a year later, it was up to the legislature to decide how to change Michigan law to make it coincide with that ruling, because Michigan has had certain crimes, very heinous crimes, that brought automatic sentences of life with no chance of parole for anyone. So the lawmakers had to figure out how to change that. I was covering the legislature as a relatively new Capitol reporter in 2013 when that was taken up. And always looking back on that, I've always kind of regretted that I wasn't able to maybe write more about the issue those before legislatures, about this issue of juvenile life without parole. I've always regretted not kind of looking at this from a wider scope and talking to some of these people. I didn't have the chance in December 2013 when this was taken up, but I did have the chance now to kind of go back and look at it, and it was always something that I really wanted to do.
You decided to communicate only through letters, not in person, not directly. Why?
One of the reasons that I came to that strategy, which I've talked to a few people about, and a lot of people have disagreed with me, that they think that I should have done this over the phone or in person. My opinion was that the letter writing idea would kind of give the inmates a better chance to reflect on the questions I was asking them. And I wanted to keep it to a very narrowed set of questions because I was going to be communicating with 10 people. And once you get above 5 sources for stories, it can get really muddied if you have so much information weighing you down.
A number of moving personal stories emerged from your reporting and these letters, and many of these inmates have had a lot of time to think about what they did, and they say they're quite different people today. Talk to us about Mark Gonzalez.
Yeah, Mark Gonzalez is one of them for sure. He committed his crime, which was pretty heinous, the fatal beating of a homeless man when he was 15 years old. He's now 31 years old. He's effectively spent half of his life in prison and has had half of his life to think about the mistake that he made as a 15-year-old. And it was a heinous mistake for sure. One of the questions that I asked the inmates I communicated with was, how often do you think about the crime that you committed? And he said in his response to this, and I'm cutting out some of it, but he says he continuously thinks about his crime. Sleep is my only break from it. Some days I dread waking up. I always do, though. I pray every day to be forgiven for all the wrong I have done and all the wrong I will do. I pray for another chance. I pray that one day I can redeem myself. Redemption can't be found in here. Most importantly, I pray for a chance to change somebody's life in a positive way.
Generally, did the people you communicated with demonstrate an awareness of their wrongdoing or of remorse? Was that typical?
It was very typical. I was in communication through these letters with about 12 prisoners. Just about all of them admitted wrong and demonstrated in the letter a lot of remorse for the crimes that they committed. There was maybe one or two who seemed to question whether they were actually guilty of their crime and kind of lay out their case for why they shouldn't have been found guilty. But overall, one of the main takeaways for me was that these people are extremely remorseful and rightfully so, because they did some very bad things.
We're talking with MERS reporter Craig Mauger about a series of letters that he has exchanged with around a dozen Michigan inmates, all of whom were sentenced to life in prison without the chance of parole, but now have a glimmer of hope as the U.S. Supreme Court is going to revisit the constitutionality of that. You heard stories of rehabilitation here as well, pretty dramatic in some cases. Talk to us about Jose Burgos.
Yeah, Jose Burgos was one of the many inmates who kind of laid out all the things that they've been doing since they've been sentenced and since they've been in prison. Many of them, and I think Jose was one of them, have obtained their GED. Many of them are involved in mentorship programs because they're very passionate about trying to steer other juveniles who may be on a path toward similar crimes away from that. Jose is involved in a mentorship program. It was something that he spent a lot of time in his letter to me about, writing about. And here's something that he said about that. The choices I have made in life are what brought me to prison. Now as an adult, the choices I have made for myself are the ones I hope will help in one day setting me free. I've been very fortunate that I have a support system still out there waiting for me. I've been blessed with friends and a family who are waiting to help in my transition back to society. What I miss the most about being free are some of the simple things in life, like sitting on my porch, watching the cars drive by, or just taking a walk. Jose is now 41 years old, and he committed his crime when he was 16, so he's been behind bars for the majority of his life.
One of the arguments invoked by opponents of retroactivity is that it will force the victims' families to revisit, and in a sense, I suppose, to relive the tragedy. Did you ask the inmates about that?
The inmates themselves brought that up in some of their letters. I didn't ask a pointed question about that, but multiple inmates pointed out that they have been forgiven by family members of their victims. Others didn't touch on that, and others kind of openly admitted that they hadn't been forgiven, and that's something that they would like to seek. I think in 2013, when the legislature took up this issue, one of the main arguments against retroactivity was this issue of bringing back family members of victims to have to relive these things, relitigate them. One thing that I didn't consider in 2013 was that some of these inmates have been forgiven by the family members. And I think it's something that inmates want to get out there, is that not all of us have not been forgiven.
Were any of these inmates unwilling to say that they deserved freedom? Did any one of them say, hey, I got what I deserved. I don't deserve freedom.
There were multiple prisoners who said that it's something that they struggle with. They hope that if they one day got a parole hearing or a resentencing hearing, that they would be deemed worthy of freedom. But there are multiple who said they questioned themselves whether they're worthy of that or not.
Craig Mauger is a reporter for MERS News based in Lansing here. We're talking about the series of letters with Michigan inmates that he's been exchanging over the past couple of months. All of the inmates were sentenced as juveniles to life in prison without parole, and the U.S. Supreme Court will be revisiting that issue here in the near future. You wrote that advocates of retroactivity are generally optimistic about it happening. Where is this optimism coming from?
The optimism is coming from the fact that after the 2012 Miller v. Alabama decision, which was the first decision kind of in this series, the Supreme Court has shown a very strong willingness to go back and look at this issue of retroactivity. And the thought process is that if they're willing to go back and look at this, they must have an interest in ruling on this subject. And advocates believe that the interest the Supreme Court has is ruling that this Miller v. Alabama decision should be implemented retroactively. There's a lot of cases that the Supreme Court could take up in the very near future to use as a venue for that ruling. The one that they've been hearing arguments on recently is the Montgomery v. Louisiana case, and there's some question over whether that will be the final one that they use to rule on retroactivity, or if another one, even potentially a Michigan case, could be one that they take up.
Mm. It turns out Attorney General Bill Schuette's office filed a brief in the Montgomery versus Louisiana case opposing retroactivity. What's the AG's line of reasoning here?
Yeah, the AG Schuette turned in a rather lengthy brief in this case, basically laying out the arguments of attorney generals in many states that they believe that having resentencing hearings for all of these inmates would be a legal nightmare and wouldn't be a good example of fair justice in our state. His idea is that if you open up these cases, some of which were settled 40 years ago, that it would bring into question the idea that justice is supposed to be final, that when a ruling is made that it's over. And for all these victims, Attorney General Schuette would argue that it's unfair to all of a sudden open up all these cases again and try to decide what the sentences should be.
On Tuesday, you attended a press conference about a package of 21 legislative proposals, I believe it's 21, involving juvenile justice. What's on the table?
Yeah, juvenile justice and criminal justice reform overall is a really hot topic in Lansing at the legislature right now. This package that the House is considering involves a laundry list of reforms to how juveniles are handled in our criminal justice system. The main reforms in this package would say that if you are 17 and you commit a crime, you're not automatically considered an adult in our criminal justice system. Right now, Michigan's one of a minority of states that say if you're 17, you're an adult when it comes to these crimes. They want to change that and say if you're 17, you should be in the juvenile system.
You should automatically be considered a juvenile?
Yes, okay. You should be automatically considered a juvenile. You could be waived up to an adult, but kind of the default would be that you are a juvenile in most crimes.
Does this issue of retroactivity fit in with other moves toward corrections reform here in Michigan?
That's an interesting question, Mark. There's some feeling among lawmakers that this issue of retroactivity is just too hot of a potato to go back to and touch. In 2013, when they took it up, it was highly debated. It was very tense. And it's a tough issue for lawmakers because you're talking about people that committed heinous crimes. These aren't people that just robbed someone. These are people who, many of them, you know, murdered someone directly and were directly responsible for it. So it would be politically difficult to go back and take this issue up. I had a lawmaker tell me a couple of months ago that he viewed this as a settled matter. This is a settled law because when they did the legislation in 2013, they basically set up a system for what would unfold if the Supreme Court did one day rule that this should be retroactive.
And there's a lot of people in law enforcement, prosecuting attorneys and what have you, that are aligned against some of these reforms.
Yeah, the law enforcement community, prosecutors, the Attorney General's office likely do not want to see a retroactive ruling coming from the Supreme Court.
Do we know that the Supreme Court of the United States will rule on this, or are they just studying the possibility?
They took oral arguments on the Montgomery v. Louisiana case earlier this fall. There's some question over kind of the parameters of that case, if that's the proper case to rule nationally on retroactivity. The expectation among advocates is that they took up this case with the intention of eventually ruling on this and settling this once and for all.
Want to thank MERS reporter Craig Mauger for talking with us about this series of letters that he exchanged with Michigan inmates who could be impacted by the U.S. Supreme Court case Montgomery v. Louisiana. They were all sentenced to life in prison without the chance of parole as juveniles. Craig, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.